Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
When I was 9 or 10, I tried to map the night sky. Alone, standing in my stepfather's garden, one dark velvet night in the Channel Island of Jersey. It's still a vivid memory. I'm gazing at an upturned bowl of blackest blue that arches way, way above. Gazillions of glinting stars pinprick the sky, many crystalline and sharp, countless others embedded in trails of silver dust. This is a vast picture show right outside the back door. I rush inside to get some paper, a pencil and torch. Then I start with the plough, the easy bit. 7 large stars and a few close by. I do my best, then go back in for a ruler, possibly a dressing gown too. When I start again, now randomly filling my page with stars, panic sets in. The angles look wrong. I rub out some stars and relocate them. Can't remember which ones I've already drawn. Are they moving? Back then, I'd no smartphone app or Google, just a compulsion to grasp and record what I was witnessing, like so many before me. The ancient Egyptians were transfixed by the stars. In their mythology, the mother goddess Isis created the Milky Way with scattered wheat grains. They believed the sun god Ra travelled across the sky each night to pass through the Duat, or realm of the dead. He re-emerged each morning, fiery and youthful, to warm the earth. Early Egyptian astronomers even mapped the Duat with their instruments. Ptolemy created a star catalogue and major astronomy text almost 2,000 years ago. He rejected Greek myths, being a mathematician and scientist, but believed the stars helped influence our human lives. Indeed, he wrote a 4-volume book on astrology. The Ottawan Indians have a more beautiful story. It tells how a giant turtle swam through the universe, its swirling feet speckling the sky with mud, each particle turning into a tiny star that now forms part of the Milky Way. Native Americans revered turtles, crediting them with wisdom, spirituality, and the creation of our planet. What stunning skies they must have watched on sultry summer nights, resting by their teepees. Today, science explains all. We know the Milky Way is a stellar system comprising hundreds of billions of stars and planets, that our solar system is cradled in one arm of this barred spiral galaxy, and that in the night sky of the northern hemisphere, we catch a sidelong view of 2 immense disks some 100,000 light years across. But we humans still need to stargaze, to have a dark sky experience that simply astounds us. Fortunately, 2 areas in Ireland, one in Kerry, the other in Mayo, have gold tier awards for the quality of their night skies. Light pollution is minimal. These are places where, on a really dark night, the naked eye can see up to 2,000 stars. One July night in West Kerry, I had a second rare encounter with the Milky Way. It was on leaving Brick's Pub near Wine Strand on the Dingle Peninsula, just after midnight and a few hours of music, chat and pints. Clear-headed, but stumbling in total darkness, my husband, our friend Dermot and I walked the half mile back to our rented cottage. The sky was clear and there were no houses to block our view, just a low hedge boreen and the sparkling sea ahead. The stars pulsated with warm, twinkling energy. Wondrous, out there, inviting celebration and joy. Amazed, we summoned our daughters, both still awake, outside the cottage. This is incredible. Really worth seeing, we promised. And it was. Since then, I've learned that the island of Sark in the Channel Islands was designated the world's very first dark sky island in 2011. Sark has no public street lighting or cars, thanks to its unique and quirky laws. The island's 500 inhabitants use very little electricity. Most importantly, to me anyway, Sark is less than 20 miles from Jersey, where my fascination with the night sky first began. I don't have a bucket list, but I do have a plan. One summer day, when funds permit, I'll take a ferry from Jersey to Sark, then a tractor ride to a hostel or B&B along the island's long, narrow road. Around midnight, after praying for a warm, cloudless night, I will step outside with my family, or alone, perhaps, and I will tilt back my head and drink in those stars.
Molly had her final stroke in April of last year. Our brave little terrier had faced old age with good humour and a waggledy tail before finally breathing her last, nestled in my lap. She had been a quirky little dog, short on brains but long on love, who had ambled into our lives 12 years before and made us laugh every day. Fergus, our tubby Jack Russell, came over for a final sniff before retreating under the table. We all grieved in our own way for the loss of our lovely Molly Bone. She was laid to rest in the garden that afternoon, a spray of bright orange dahlias planted by her side. Over the next few days, it dawned on Fergus that he was now the top dog, and he began to swagger around the house. Well, as much swaggering as his little legs would allow. With no more sharing the treats or vying for our affection, he blossomed, and we realised that he had been living in Molly's shadow since he joined our family 2 years before. 6 months in an animal shelter had clearly taken its toll. He was a shy and snappy ball of anxiety when he first arrived, but over time he had slowly allowed himself to trust us. But now was his chance to shine, and shine he did, revelling in long summer days, chasing seagulls on the beach, or racing through peat and heather on the bog. Evenings were spent on the couch, tucked in between my husband and myself, making sure he had a paw touching both of us at all times. Snuggled into the essence of us, he felt safe and secure in his favourite place. As summer turned to autumn, we noticed Fergus spending most of his days looking forlornly out the window. Our little man was lonely, and I realised that it might be time to add to our canine family once more. When I contacted our local rescue organisation, they asked what kind of dog we would prefer. I didn't hesitate for a moment. An ex-racing greyhound, a leggy lady who would spend the rest of her days just being herself and not having to run for her life. They suggested a 6-year-old black and grey called Millie. She was simply beautiful, gentle and elegant, with deep brown eyes that hoped for, but didn't necessarily expect, kindness. We gave her a new name for her new start, Pooka Poo. It got the wag of approval, her slender hips swaying like a metronome, eyes half shut in delight. We couldn't wait to bring her home to meet the little man himself. The initial introductions went well, copious sniffs along with the odd grumble and growl to work out the hierarchical order. Unsurprisingly, our little tubster came out on top. Fergus loved to show off, and with Pooka, he had a rapt audience. She was his shadow for the first few days until she began to relax into her new home. As they began to play together, running up and down the hall, sliding around corners, chasing a balled up pair of socks pilfered from the wash basket, we saw her true personality emerge. Where she had once flinched whenever we showed her affection, she now sidled up for a reassuring rub behind the ears. We realised she had finally relaxed into our family when she thundered down the hall like a small horse to greet us one morning, a wide grin on her greying muzzle and her tail held aloft with confidence. It was an absolute joy watching her realise that this was her life now. Walkies were the funniest, little and large. Poor Fergus had to work 3 times harder to keep up, his little legs pumping to keep pace with her. At this rate, he wasn't tubby for long. Having such long legs may have been an asset for Pooka, but some ground rules had to be put in place after a chicken sandwich disappeared from the kitchen table and into her tummy in the blink of an eye. Fergus could only watch from far below with ill-disguised envy. She liked the comfy, fleece-lined bed we bought for her, but she loved the couch and at full stretch almost took up its entire length. Looking at the calluses on her joints and hip bones from lying on bare concrete in her previous life, I couldn't begrudge her the couch, even if it meant that we were squished up into one small corner with Fergus perched like a disgruntled owl between us. He needn't have worried about losing his place in our family. We loved him even more for accepting this beautiful creature and sharing his favourite place with her, albeit with just the occasional grumble. I like to think that he recognised her need to be saved, just like he was. Every evening, feeling safe and secure, our little tubster and our lovely long nose sigh and stretch and settle into the essence of us.
I was raised in a house of holy pictures, statues and relics. Every night we knelt in the kitchen, backs to the television, faces to the Sacred Heart, to say the Rosary, the Litany of the Saints, and any other trimmings that could be added on. Our bedrooms were dominated by religious prints. Statues of Mary and Jesus occupied windowsills and, depending on the season, were adorned with daffodils, daisies and primroses. Our parents' room had the saddest of all holy pictures, Jesus crowned with thorns. And this representation of the tortured Christ hung in their bedroom for as long as I could remember. While holy pictures reminded us of our heavenly friends, relics had a more practical use. We had one good one that our parents swore by. It belonged to St. Martin de Porres and was about the size of a small bookmark. Underneath Martin's picture, that we thought was a photo, was a minuscule piece of gauze that claimed to have touched the body of the gentle saint. The relic was kept on the Sacred Heart's altar in the kitchen and had grown leaf thin after many years of application and rubbing on the lumps, bumps, cuts, stings and scalds suffered by my siblings and me. When my youngest brother survived knocking himself out by banging his head on the hall tiles, we attributed it to the fact that Dad had immediately applied the relic to the injury, which I proudly reported as our own personal miracle to the nun in school the next day. Sister was impressed by this domestic miracle, and an agreeable afternoon was passed as she spun us stories of other remarkable relics. Her favourite was the relic of St. Adjutor in the friary in Wexford town. Known locally as the Little Saint, the relic is kept in a wax effigy at the back of the church. It was a dramatic and bloody tale. Sister did it justice and had us all deliciously terrified before we went home and begged our mothers to drive us into town immediately to see the poor little saint. On a trip to Pisa a few years ago, I was reminded of our long-ago reverence for religious artefacts. While I had a little siesta, my husband went for a walk along the banks of the River Arno, and he returned in triumph to tell me that he'd come across a beautiful church, Santa Maria della Spina, which had been specially built in the 13th century to house a thorn saved from Christ's crown of thorns. I marvelled that in 4 decades of marriage, my husband had never revealed any fascination for things holy and miraculous, until now. But I went with him to the church and we paid €2 each to view the holy thorn, or spina, which the guidebook said was in a tabernacle on the wall. Sadly, the tabernacle turned out to be empty, and a little notice under it said that the spina, in its gold casket, reposed in the parish church of Santa Chiara. On the way out, we noticed a poster advertising the Pergolesi's Stabat Mater would be performed here tonight at 8 p.m. And seeing as it was Holy Week, and we hadn't done anything else that was vaguely devotional, we decided to return for the concert. We arrived back well before 8 and were perturbed to see a police car and 3 police officers at the front of the church. We wondered what kind of crime had been committed and if our concert would be cancelled as a result. But the police officers, a very fine-looking man, and 2 women whose police hats perched atop manes of hair that could have featured in an ad for shampoo, had a relaxed look about them as they chatted at the door with the priest. Eventually, the policeman went into the church, and with dramatic tosses of their flowing tresses, the police women leapt into the patrol car and drove off. We joined the queue into the candlelit church. Our handsome policeman stood to attention at the top of the church, and there in the centre of the altar stood the gold reliquary of La Spina, on day release, it seemed, from Santa Chiara. Stabat Mater Dolorosa Juxta Crucem Lacrimosa. The soprano and alto duet in the first movement sent chills up my spine. I glanced at our policeman to see if he was affected as Pergolesi's music soared and the sorrow of the mother of the crucified Christ filled the church. But the policeman's eyes never wavered from the little gold shrine that he and the 2 policewomen had escorted to the church, and that he was charged with guarding for the duration of the concert. When the final notes drifted and disappeared heavenward and the applause died down, an elderly priest approached the altar, and as he lifted the reliquary high to bless us, I could see the cruel curved thorn behind the glass window. Quiet and solemn now, as befitted 2 Irish a la carte Catholics abroad in Holy Week, we linked arms and went into the balmy Italian night, the final Amen still ringing in our ears.
Amy moved in at the start of the year. She was dark, petite, and very pretty. For the first while, our only significant interaction was her hissing furiously at me from the shadows at the top of the stairs, which gave me quite a start last thing at night. The rest of the time she spent hiding under the new lodger's bed. After a while, I asked Mariana, the lodger, what was the story with the cat? It turned out that she, Mariana, was slightly allergic to Amy, the cat, and so rarely petted her. We didn't get into why she then had a cat in the first place, but nevertheless, there we were. I spent time getting to know Amy, mainly by feeding her and gently reaching through the banisters to pet her whenever she'd appear at the top of the stairs. It worked a treat, and within a couple of months she was following me around the house, demanding attention. I felt no small amount of pride, thinking to myself, if I've done nothing else in this life, at least I have habituated 1 cat. Then Mariana announced she was moving to a bigger, more central apartment, one that unfortunately couldn't accommodate a cat. She reassured me that it would only take a week or 2 for her to find a new home for Amy. That was 6 months ago, so I guess I have a cat now. I'd often thought about getting one, but figured that as I travelled so much for work, it would be impractical. Then the great unpleasantness began, and I found myself hardly travelling at all. And anyway, isn't it nice to have a cat? I was heading to the airport recently, on my way to visit family in Canada, when I got a frantic call from another Amy. This one, a friend from Paris, who writes wonderfully gruesome horror novels for young adults. It turns out she was also heading to the airport, and the friend she was going to stay with in Dublin had all just come down with COVID, and could she possibly sleep on my couch? No, not at all, I said. She could have the whole house as long as she didn't mind feeding the cat. I explained there was a kind of a robot feeder thing that clicked open with a serving of dry food every morning, and all she'd have to do was feed her in the evenings and let her in and out. Amy, the writer, was tickled to hear the cat had the same name, and that she was black as night, like a true witch's familiar. It was some time later that I learned what had happened the next morning. I'd neglected to mention the robot feeder thing had a feature where a brief snippet of the owner's voice could be recorded, then played back to alert the cat that breakfast was served. That morning, while Amy the writer was still half asleep, coming to in a strange bed in a new house, she was suddenly jolted wide awake when she heard an odd noise downstairs, followed by my unmistakable voice calling, "Amy? Amy? Amy?" She didn't know what was happening. Had I suddenly returned from Montreal? Did I have some kind of international intercom set up? Or the worst possible option, had my plane gone down overnight, and was she now somehow hearing my ghost trying to communicate with her? It didn't take her too long to figure out what was going on. But up until that point, it seems that between us, my cat and I had managed to absolutely terrify the queen of teen scream.
I'm lying on the flat of my back, and about 6 feet above me, I can see my heart. It's twitching and pulsing erratically. The arteries and blood vessels that feed it appear distended and blackened. It looks like a tiny ensnared animal struggling for its life, beating out its last desperate staccato rhythm. Someone tells me not to move. "I'm cold," I say, as I drift in and out of consciousness and slowly slip away. In 1959, two American scientists, William J. Buehler and Frederick Wang, were working for the US Navy researching new materials for the nose cones of missiles. Through an accident in the lab, they discovered a versatile new metal alloy that they named Nitinol, which stands for Nickel Titanium Naval Ordnance Lab, after the place where this wonder metal was discovered. While their research was ultimately about making more efficient weapons of war, the irony is that their discovery led to a wide variety of life-saving applications, including surgical implements such as cardiac stents, which is what had me lying on the flat of my back, looking at the inner workings of my heart on an X-ray screen, as a tiny piece of wire gauze, a cardiac stent just 2.5 millimetres in diameter, was inserted into my groin and guided through my body to a blockage in one of my coronary arteries. The stent is wrapped around a tiny balloon on the end of a long, thin guide wire. When in place, the balloon is inflated and the stent gently forces the blocked artery open. The balloon is then deflated and removed. The stent remains locked in place, holding the previously narrowed artery open, thus ensuring that my blood flows where it's supposed to and hopefully prolongs my life. The procedure takes about an hour, and while it's routine for the staff who carry it out daily, to me, it is a wonder the stuff of science fiction. From the nose cones of missiles to the interior of my heart, that tiny piece of nickel, a very small component of the stent, had already taken an incredible journey. Travelling across time and space, it had begun its life 4.6 billion years ago, hurtling through the universe as part of an asteroid. Asteroids are leftovers from the formation of our universe, the remains of enormous interstellar collisions. The one that landed in Mexico 66 million years ago was about 9 miles across, and when it struck the Earth, it was travelling about 45,000 miles per hour. It left a crater 12 miles deep and 110 miles across. This is the collision that's believed to have wiped out the dinosaurs. Every day, about 50 tons of cosmic debris fall to Earth. The vast majority of it burns up while entering the atmosphere, leaving the bright trail we call shooting stars. Some asteroids are made entirely of rock. Others are metallic or a combination of both. 95% of asteroids contain nickel. Having fallen to Earth, the nickel used in my surgery would have lain undiscovered until eventually it was mined, manipulated, machined and refined before finally being sculpted into a piece of gauze so fine and delicate it could be inserted into an artery in the human heart. But deep in its subatomic memory, it is and will remain a tiny piece of asteroid, trapped forever in my heart by the wonder of modern medicine. Life is precious, and life is short, and we are here but for the briefest of time. In the life of a star, we are but the blink of an eye. When I die, this tiny piece of life-saving metal will pass out of my body and fall to Earth once more. I am but a custodian, the briefest of stopovers on its long journey through the universe. I love to travel, and one day I plan to find a darkened headland somewhere where I can stand poised between the Earth below and the starlit sky above. If I'm lucky enough, I might see a shooting star blaze its fiery trail across the night sky, leaving in its wake a collection of iridescent interstellar dust. And I will marvel at how ultimately we are all made of the stars, and I will give thanks to the universe for that little piece of space dust lodged forever in my heart.
Night Walker. The country is no place for the night walker. There are no street lamps and chaos lunges from a ditch. Shapes lurk in the bushes. The moon is nacreous, a cold, bright stalker. You walk ahead of yourself, fearful of your demons. Even the tame ones turn in the dark, sizing you up with their eyes. Your guardian angel stays well back. When a fox barks, he whines and edges close for protection. The feathers on his neck rise. For God's sake, you tell him, bark. Venus watches, and the fox stares at him with foxy contempt. When you see the still pool, you whistle for your demons. Stay, you order, drink. They gather and their heads dip. They are tired and thirsty. They've been with you a long time. The friendly sky is full of night animals. They wish you no harm, but only the moon can grant your wish and pull the tide across the plain up to your house on the hill.
portrait of a memory. This photograph appears in my memories. I'm seated inside a tour boat, more like a bus. Two windows behind me and in front of me show the views. The ripple of water on Dunluce Loch, the tones of green of the Poison Glen and Errigal. You could paint this photo in shades of blue. In this moment, on this lake, I am alone, as if the family that surrounded me has disappeared. While the tour guide urges us to keep a watch for the resident ghost, the green lady of the estate. I am immersed in my thoughts, looking out, striving to see what is coming at us next. You could paint a slow flow from the turquoise joy of a family fun day to the dark navy of my worries, as fears for a son's health haunt in ice blue. Portrait of a mother on a boat trip looking out. Let her stay there, drifting. Paint it mystic blue.
On this morning's programme, we heard The Milky Way by Gail Seacamp. The Arrival of Pooka Poo was by Fiona Hyland. Santa Maria della Spina by A.M. Cousins. The Two Amys was by Connor Horgan. Star Stuff by Jim Sperrin. Nightwalker, a poem by Mary O'Malley. And Portrait of a Memory, a poem by Denise Blake. The music was Pretty Stars Were Made to Shine by Bill Frisell. Promenade, Walking the Dog by Gershwin, arranged for clarinet and piano by Anthony Wakefield and played by Richard Hosford, Ian Brown and the Nash Ensemble. The duet Stabat Mater Dolorosa from Pergolesi's Stabat Mater, sung by Raquel Harnish and Sarah Mingardo with Orchestra Mozart, conducted by Claudio Abbado. The Twilight Zone theme was by John Williams. Woodstock by Joni Mitchell. And Starlight Ethereal Silence by Valerie June. To find out more about places in Ireland to view the night sky, as mentioned in Gail Seacamp's essay, Kerry, Mayo and also Dava Park in County Tyrone, see darksky.ie. And Conor Horgan's essay, The Two Amys, is included in the collection of scripts from this programme, Sunday Miscellany, a selection from 2018 to 2023, which is published by New Island Books. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. You can find more from this and other RTE arts and culture programmes on rte.ie/culture. And to listen back to this morning's programme, go to the RTE radio app.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.